Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. Since the pandemic hit and made touring and performing impossible, I've taken to broadcasting interviews with people who I can't visit in person anymore. They're live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Western European time on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. All these interviews also then go out in podcast form afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovics.com or get the David Rovics mobile app. I also do a live concert from my living room on the last Saturday of each month, which is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. in Belfast, 10 p.m. in Berlin. Today, we're spending the hour with Henry Bell. Originally from Bristol, England, and for a long time now a resident of Glasgow, Scotland, Henry is a person with a very broad skill set, a rare example of someone who excels both as an artist and as an organizer, an award-winning poet, as well as an editor of poetry anthologies and other books, as well as magazines, an organizer of festivals in Scotland and tours of Palestine, and the author of the 2018 biography of legendary Scottish labor leader John McLean, hero, hero of Red Clydeside. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Henry Bell, welcome to my little live stream show.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Ever since the pandemic hit and all the economic chaos, particularly in the United States, I have been thinking more of John McLean and your book than I had in years. Because, I mean, we're looking at 40 million evictions in this country, possibly by the end of September, if the politicians don't do anything to prevent that. And rent strike is a very relevant concept. Can we just start with, there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but can we just start out with who was John McLean?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it is more relevant now than ever, because he was a labor leader in Scotland who kind of rose to mass prominence at a moment when there was a huge crisis of capitalism that was based around housing insecurity, work insecurity, and food insecurity. And yeah, that's where a lot of the world is heading, certainly. Yeah, so to give you the skinny on McLean, he was a school teacher from Glasgow, and he kind of came up through the Social Democratic movement. So he was part of the Social Democratic Federation that the likes of James Connolly and people were members of at the time. And that kind of was his bread and butter for all the pre-war years. He spent his time fighting elections. He spent his time pamphleting and cycling kind of around the west of Scotland and traveling further than that, trying to spread the word of Marxism. And he really kind of believed in the ballot box, and he believed in a laborism that could kind of mobilize people at the factory gates and in parliament and change society. And that all changed very suddenly for him when the First World War broke out. He was hugely disillusioned to see the Labour Party in Britain and the Social Democratic Party in Germany kind of abandon the idea of a working class international and support the kind of imperialism of their native countries. And that just radicalized him almost overnight into becoming a communist revolutionary, and set him on a kind of trajectory through a period of huge unrest in the west of Scotland, where he became kind of the most dangerous man in Britain, was what the British secret police called him.
That nationalism that you describe on the part of the Labour Party is also so familiar today, isn't it? I mean, especially when we think about both major parties here in the United States, which often it seems like the Democrats are the more militaristic of the two these days in terms of supporting imperialism and talking about building them. I mean, they just voted in the biggest military budget in the history of the world again in this country, which. Yeah, also another one of these many, many parallel historical. I mean, I think that period seems more relevant than ever. I mean, the depression and the teens during World War One and all that was going on. And how did the rent strike get started?
The rent strike was basically a situation in Glasgow where, on the one hand, you had a huge amount of the population whose main income was now coming from the army, masses of people signed up. There was a lot of enthusiasm for the war in a lot of areas of Glasgow, a lot of jingoism about. And at the same time, you had Glasgow as kind of the workshop of the British Empire. So at that time, a third of all ships at sea in the world were built in Glasgow, a quarter of all steam locomotives, huge amounts of munitions, and huge amounts of steel for all kinds of work were all produced on Clydeside. And that meant that actually wages were skyrocketing for some people that worked in those industries, a sort of labour aristocracy, but they were stagnating for soldiers and, of course, for the massive unemployed population as well. It also sucked in labour from the Highlands, from Ireland and from the colonies. Glasgow's always had a kind of sponge economy where when the empire disenfranchised certain areas, they could be drawn into slums in Glasgow as a kind of expendable workforce. And so what you saw was suddenly rents skyrocketing and a massive split effectively between those that could afford these rents and those that couldn't. And women in Govan, which is a working class neighbourhood of the city, organised first, just in their streets, they organised to resist all evictions. So they were
Mrs. Barber's Army.
Mrs. Barber's Army.
Of the Alistair Hewlett song that I first learned about Red Clydeside entirely through songs.
I can't recommend anything more than Alistair's album Red Clydeside for learning about it. It's the most fun way to learn the history.
The perfect complement to your book, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, so Mrs. Barber organized the tenements. So Glasgow housing is based on a tenement system where you have six or eight flats up a stair, and then there's a communal stair. And so they would have women stationed in each close, and they would give the alarm if any bailiffs were seen coming. And all the women from the street would rush out with pots and pans and eggs and flour, and they would pelt the bailiffs until they left. And kind of early on, this was kind of seen as quite eccentric and kind of mocked in the capitalist establishment press. But it became evident very quickly that no one could be evicted in Govan. And it spread across the city. So by November of 1915, so only a year into the war, there were some 60,000 households on rent strike in the city.
Wow.
Which was really enough to terrify the capitalist classes. And this was the moment that John McLean realized that there was what he felt was a revolutionary potential on Clydeside, because he felt that if the war could be stopped in any way, it was Glasgow that could stop it. If the factories could be brought down, then the war couldn't be continued, and that would be the greatest blow against imperialism that could be struck. And he was very upfront about the fact that he was doing that not just for the British working class or the Scottish working class, but the German working class as well, that it was no separation for him. The government responded with a series of laws. The Munitions Act was the first of them, and it basically, they made it illegal for anyone to change jobs, they made it illegal for anyone to strike, and they made it legal for bosses to hand wages directly to landlords without them ever going into the hands of the workers. So that was known as the Industrial Slavery Act in Scotland. And
informally known as the Industrial Slavery Act. And that did not calm things down.
No, it absolutely radicalized the workforce. So suddenly these women who'd been at the vanguard of this rent strike had the support of the massive factory and shipyard population. And so there was a test case where some shipbuilders had gone on strike in solidarity with someone who'd been dismissed from their post. And so all of the women marched into the city centre, and all of the 18 major steelworks and shipyards struck. So there was perhaps some 70 or 80,000 people marched into the centre of Glasgow and surrounded the court where this special munitions tribunal was being held against these workers. There's a few different accounts of what happened, but certainly the government folded and the sheriff and Lord Provost of Glasgow got in touch with the government in London and said that they were going to lose control of the city. And a rent freeze was brought in across the whole of the UK. So all rents were frozen at 1914 levels, which was a fascinating moment for a couple of reasons. One, because it's the first mass political strike that happens. That's not a strike for wages or conditions. It's a broad-based whole class strike that happens in Scotland. And that really caught Maclean's imagination, because at the time he was reading Rosa Luxemburg's mass strike, which was about similar movements in Germany. So he felt that there was a lot to learn and link up there. And the other thing was that it was a really tangible victory that that socialists across Glasgow could now say, your rents are low, and it's because we organised and fought back. And that was
absolutely
probably,
and across the UK too.
Yeah, huge victory against the landlords.
And you, when you're talking about how Glasgow always played this role of being like a sponge city for the refugees from empire and who could go work in factories and that sort of thing, at that time, it could have easily, as it did in other cities like Chicago, for example, it could have, things could have gone, I mean, some similar dynamics could have gone very different ways, like in Chicago, as a result of a lot of similar social and economic pressures. There were what became known as race riots, whether the term is an appropriate one or not. But in any case, it was people shooting at each other on the basis of their race, and it was all wrapped up in union struggle at the slaughterhouses in Chicago and a strike that was going on and black strike breakers and the whole dynamic that they try to, the bosses using one group against another, largely blacks against Poles. But in Glasgow, that dynamic didn't get established, and things went a very different way, it sounds like.
There were certainly attempts at that kind of division, both from the government and within the labour movement. But I think there's a really interesting kind of story to tell about it, that the main division in Glasgow and in Belfast, just across the Irish Sea, is the sectarian divide, which is a kind of long established hatred that is almost always conjured up by the ruling class when it's convenient to them.
And they tried to do that, get the Catholics against the Protestants?
Yeah, certainly. And there were kind of organizations set up, such as the Middle Class Defense Union, that had kind of broadly anti-Catholic propaganda, suggesting that the other major population in Glasgow at the time was, there were around 30 or 40,000 Jewish people living in the Gorbals, which was a neighborhood immediately next to the river. And there was a lot of propaganda, again, saying that this socialism and communism was a Jewish plot against the state. But I think the inspiring thing about that period, both in Belfast and in Glasgow, is that it's one of the few times that sectarianism hasn't managed to win out, and that there have been kind of broad organizing across the religious divide in the cities. And in the great unrest just before the First World War in 1908 in Belfast, there was a huge strike, including a police strike, where the police joined the workers in the shipyards and stuff. And it's actually the only time, other than this year with COVID, that there haven't been sectarian marches through the city, that Republican and Loyalist flute bands marched together down the Shankill Road as a show of unity during the strike at that point. So yeah, no, there certainly was potential for that. And in Glasgow, similarly, By 1919, when Red Clydeside had kind of reached its zenith with huge numbers of soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers returning from the front to find that there was no work and there was a coming depression. At that point, there was a race riot in the city. And again, there were attempts to stir it up, but it was completely overshadowed by acts of unity and solidarity at that time as well. There's lots of like far less glorious periods in Glasgow's history for those divides, though, to be fair.
But at that time, it was there were conflicts between Catholics and Protestants, but they were overshadowed by much greater unity of the working class in 1919.
Yeah, on the issues such as the rent strike and housing, in kind of straightforward industrial struggles, it's more complex, because there was a huge amount of discrimination against Catholics at the time in the workplace. So most of the jobs that I'm talking about in munitions factories and on the shipyards were purely Protestant jobs. Catholics couldn't work in those positions. And so,
just like in Belfast.
Yeah, exactly the same setup where, you simply could not get employment if you had a Catholic surname. And so their involvement in kind of syndicalism and in the workplace organizing was less so. Although interestingly, kind of as a result of that prejudice, some of the most radical figures and kind of founding figures of the British Communist Party in the 20s, as well as leading anarchists, come from the Catholic and Jewish communities in Glasgow because they were excluded from the more kind of formalized, straight-laced Labour Party that ended up disappointing so many.
Yeah, yeah. I love the idea that they were throwing the women in Pollock Shaw's were throwing eggs at the bailiffs.
Yeah, so it was, yeah, eggs and flour was what they were pelting the bailiffs with on these street corners, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Flour, too.
What they'd call rough music. So, yeah, banging pots and pans and singing songs at them to chase them down the streets. Yeah, it must have been a lot of fun, I think.
Fantastic. And it sounds even like, you know, here in Portland, every day the police declare a riot every time there's a protest in the evening. And it's hard to say exactly what their rationale is for a riot, but it often seems to have to do with empty plastic bottles being thrown in their direction. And of course, you know, they're wearing riot gear, so this is not gonna do anything to them, right? But I think eggs might be even better, because I mean, it would be really hard to declare a riot when somebody throws an egg at you, but I mean, they could do it, I'm sure, but I think eggs are much better than plastic bottles, it occurs to me now.
And I think humiliating the people you're going for is always a good bet, and it's hard to look serious when you're covered in eggs and flour, I reckon. The strike being organized in Oregon, is that right at the moment?
What's that?
Is there kind of organizing work towards a rent strike where you are?
Yes, all over the country there's rent strike and eviction defense groups starting up, and I'm very much involved with that effort here in Portland with a group called Portland Emergency Eviction Response, and actually very much modeled after the rent strikes in other times in other places. In terms of trying to mobilize people to, like, I mean, in Glasgow, the women are watching for the bailiffs to arrive, which is one way to figure out when you need to act, right? And then, of course, the rent strike wars in the 1840s in upstate New York, they had tin horns that tenant farmers would blow on in order to let the people in the rest of the mountain know that they need to go somewhere quick and defend a tenant farmer. But and then in the 1980s in New York City, it was the more sort of at least at that time modern version, which was the telephone tree, right? You call one person, and that person, every time you call, everybody you call already knows, they already have a list of 10 other people that they are going to call. And then everybody makes their assigned phone calls, and then they rush out the door to wherever they're supposed to be going. So the idea with that is to be able to respond within an hour to an attempted eviction. And in the squats, they were usually big buildings where you could have a lot of barricades. So the idea was to build enough of a barricade structure that you could effectively keep the police out for an hour, which became a big problem when the chief of police got a tank with a battering ram, which they literally did. They got an armored vehicle with a battering ram on it, which then made it more easy to get into the squats more quickly. But that's half the squats were able to be saved this way through these methods. But yeah, but this this idea is, it's just very ripe. I think.
Yeah.
What's going on with that kind of with rent strike activity in the UK right now? Is things that people are being more or less maintained by the government for the time being? So like in Canada, so it's not like a big hotbed of that kind of activity at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of housing activism around here. There's an organization called Living Rent who are forming tenants unions in different neighborhoods across Scotland. But at the minute, most people are eligible to access state support at the moment. And there's also rent deferrals for a huge number of people and through housing associations and stuff. So it hasn't come to a head yet, but I mean, there's been a lot of rumblings in the papers, the usual kind of thing where they're just wondering, you know, how we as landlords can, you know, continue to make a living and provide housing if we're not getting our rents.
I love how they talk about providing housing as if they're ever in the business of providing housing, you know, and then they talk about the jobs that they're providing for the property managers and the underpaid people who are, you know, I mean, nothing against hiring undocumented workers, but, you know, you know that they're doing it for the wrong reasons. And, you know, because it's the cheapest people they can get. And it's just around here, that's certainly the situation with these landlord corporations. Oh,
they're quite literally vampires, yeah.
Yeah.
But we're at a similar moment as well, or we're approaching a similar moment to the time of McLean, in that like capital is so entirely being stored in property. The value of your home and the basically farming of human beings that's going on by slum landlords is at the highest level that it's been at here since the 1930s and the kind of establishment of social housing. And I think that's true across Europe. And I think it's certainly true in America, that the kind of the check or the limited checks on the market and defense that was built up by socialism over the years, that was public housing, has been eroded to such an extent that it's now just, absolute Victorian levels of exploitation in the housing sector.
And then rent control over private housing, controlling the increase of rent over in privately owned housing. That's also taken lots of big hits especially since Thatcher, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no rent controls anywhere in Scotland. Private landlords can charge what they want. The only thing that's been a kind of delight is that private landlords have been hollowing out Edinburgh for decades now. Kind of the old town has kind of pockets of social housing left and the whole rest of it is Airbnbs. Rents are sky high in the city, kind of almost twice what they are in Glasgow. And suddenly, obviously, they've lost all of their customers. So I think we're about to see a big rent dip in Edinburgh, at least.
Yeah, I guess in a similar situation, like with San Francisco and New York City, and the rents are apparently going down by 10%. But they need to go down a heck of a lot more than 10%. I mean, it was already insane. And so, yeah, it's a very interesting where things might go with this. What a moment, huh?
Definitely. I mean, that's the conclusion of my book, or what I try and draw on, is that what McLean saw was this this massive crisis moment for capitalism in the First World War was just dragging out all of the contradictions that obviously Marxists are aware of, to a point where it was all that was being discussed in the street was the massive inequality and the very clear exploiters and exploited. And I think, again, through the pandemic, we're seeing just so clearly those lines, which is, you know, perhaps no great surprise to you or me or most people watching this, but I think a whole lot of people that live a kind of a life not examining that or kind of taking in some of the propaganda, like you say, about people providing jobs or providing housing or kind of what is socially useful and what is socially exploitative in our society is now, I think, very, very clearly apparent. And also which workers we actually need and which people are, in fact, not working, not producing stuff for us, what the bankers and all the people staying home really have to contribute when the shop workers and care workers are out in the streets. Yeah,
all these things are being just thrown into the fore and starkly sort of revealed in terms of what is really essential work and what is not. And I remember meeting a student from China in Seattle like 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and 30 years ago, I guess. Yeah. And and I asked him what he was studying. And he said, basically, he's studying to do something other than farming. And so it's of limited value.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting answer. He must have gotten really tired of saying what his major was. But, you know, it's a, yeah. What is the workers' the workers' theater, that sounds, and I imagine due to the pandemic, there's not a lot of workers' theater or any other kind of theater going on, but that looks like a wonderful project that you've been involved with. Is that still happening or will be happening or theoretically still happening?
Yeah, hopefully it'll be happening again. Yeah, as you say, there's not a lot of theater happening at the minute, but the workers' theater is a workers' cooperative in Glasgow and Edinburgh looking to kind of build a worker-owned venue. So it was kind of, it's a serious project, but also kind of part and an experiment and a kind of provocation to the fact that, you know, I work and have worked quite a lot in theatre and events, and almost everyone I know is precarious. You kind of go from freelance contract to freelance contract. There's less and less money for technicians, for performers. And all of that in Scotland's against the backdrop that we have the largest arts festival in the world happening every year in Edinburgh, and billions and billions of pounds come into the country for supposedly for theatre. That's what they're coming to see. And it all ends up in the hands of the people that own the venues. Ends up back with the landlords, as it always does. And so it's kind of looking at that idea of kind of how spaces are rented to us and used as performers and as artists as well, and what that actually means, and why are we renting space to play in or renting space to rehearse in?
Why is that the case in the first place?
Why modeled it, and why is so much of the arts modeled on a kind of neoliberal basis? Why do we have so much structure around management and managers and such top heavy salaries, where we have these artistic directors and people with secure jobs who, you know, are currently furloughed on six figure salaries in some cases, while the entire workforce is made redundant. It was kind of a project to look at that. So the concept is to own and run an art space and theatre in the city where all work is shared, everyone's paid the same, and through membership of the collective, you get access to make and share work in the space, which has kind of been interesting. We've kind of had like moments where we've kind of been building towards a building with people, and then they're not willing to adopt a structure where their artistic director earns the same as the person that cleans the building. And they've kind of thought, oh, you have that in your manifesto, but we kind of thought that was like, you know, a statement. It's like, no, that's really,
oh my goodness,
central to the model that we need to build. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to do that. But in the meantime, we've just been doing kind of residencies and pop-up festivals and stuff. So we had in February there, just before the thing, we had a festival called Something Has to Happen, which was about all these tensions that were already lying there and what was going to happen about it. And we had all sorts. We had a Transylvanian Cayley with there's a large Roma community here, and we had bands from them playing, and we flew in some dancers from Hungary to teach folk dancing, but in a kind of Cayley style. And we had kind of theatre pieces and dance, stand-up, kids shows and stuff. And then kind of amongst that, we had discussions. So the idea is also for it to be kind of explicitly a political space. So we had probably the like most enjoyable and uncomfortable hour and a half I've had in a while, which was a discussion about theatre as a gentrifying force, where some very robust arguments were had about how you make art in a way that doesn't contribute to the capitalization of these areas and spaces that we live in.
And how, I mean, that's extremely difficult, because isn't it? Because when you're living in a capitalist society, I mean, those of us, and I count myself very much among them, who are always ending up moving into neighborhoods that are start out being very multicultural and then end up not being, you know, after a while, by the time I have to leave, because I've been priced out too, you know, it's this process those of us who according to the color of our skin and profession and whatever else are the gentrifiers, you know, at least I'm not one of the ones going in and flipping houses, right? I'm just trying to find a place I can afford to live in, but either way I'll get lumped in as a gentrifier, and that's appropriate as well, because I'm one of the ones who's making the neighborhood feel safe for the real gentrifiers who are going to come in and flip houses once there's a high enough percentage of white people that other white people want to move, you know, those white people that don't want to live in a more multicultural environment, you know, at some point feel safe to move to the environment. And I'm one of the ones who's like the shock troops of this process in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you open up an art space in a neighborhood, how do you make sure that you're not doing that? How do you build that? I mean, there was kind of, I think some of the more interesting elements of the discussion were like, there's obviously been tactics, particularly in Berlin, in Kreuzberg and places, but also in LA, where you do that by making the neighborhood unsafe. Like you do it by torching luxury cars around the venue that you're opening.
Yeah, that's one way. It's high risk, but...
It's high risk, but effective to some extent. But then, of course, you have the issue that, like, we want, and we also want working class people and people of color to live in nice neighborhoods, and we shouldn't have to destroy our neighborhoods to stop people coming in and exploiting that housing and turning around. And, you know, it shouldn't be like someone in the meeting suggested making fake Nazi propaganda and demonstrations to put up to as if there was like a radical right in the neighborhood, which is a kind of wild extreme to go to.
But
I mean, I think I think we should have bread and roses too. And I think we shouldn't shy away from saying we want art in these places and we want our neighborhoods to be beautiful. But I think we need to be always listening to those people that are being excluded or priced out from the neighborhood and putting them forward to make decisions about whether these spaces go ahead or what's held in these spaces and what happens. And really, I think the best action that we can take is to have as much socially controlled housing and as much anti-landlord activity as possible going on in those neighborhoods. And I think if you can make it a hostile environment for landlords, that's the battle won. And whether that's torching their Mercedes or stopping evictions, both have the same effect, I think.
Sometimes, if at least from a just, it might be just a purely emotional therapeutic angle here, but I feel like just by defacing public property, I'm contributing just a little bit to making the neighborhoods less friendly for the gentrifiers and the landlords. You know, just when there's like lots of signs around saying things like rent strike and you know, who gave you the right to be a landlord and that sort of thing, I think it freaks them out a little bit. Maybe they miss a sale. You know, if somebody comes to look at that real estate and then, oh, there's that sign again written the telephone pole in front of the house. I don't know. It takes more extreme action. But
one of the things about researching Red Clydeside I really enjoyed was that at the time there was a huge network of socialist Sunday schools in the city. So there were some 60 or 70 groups where every Sunday kids would go, and they ranged from quite liberal kind of social democratic things to really quite extreme Marxist and anarchist schools for kids, where they would sit and read Marx. But one of my favorite ones was the Proletarian Sunday School in Govan Hill. And to graduate when they were 10, these kids, to become young comrades and get to the next level, they had to go out with some paint or some chalk and find a city council building to deface in some way to show
that they're
real rebels. I think, I want to start with that up again at some point.
Excellent. And then by the time they turn 16, they have to throw an egg at a bailiff, maybe?
Yeah.
That's dangerous, though. And this last year, you did this Chili Habibi thing. You were talking about the Hungarian folk dancers doing a Kaylee, and that reminded me of this other project that's wonderful, cross-cultural thing. That can you talk about what that was? And I guess it's not going on this year. No Fringe Festival this year, right?
Yeah, no Fringe this year, which is like, it's an interesting one though, not being Fringe, because it's such a kind of corporate event in many ways, but it like, all, you know, anything that massive, I mean, the population of the city doubles, there's thousands and thousands of shows on, so anything that big obviously has a subculture and a counterculture to it, and so there's a lot to miss about it as well. I'd always said that it should be like the Olympics and only happen every 4 years because it's so destructive, but actually now that we're having a year off, I quite miss it. Chil Habibi was a show that me and my friend Sara Sharawi put on for a month in Edinburgh, where we had a kind of Scottish Arab cabaret every night for a month, so 30 different shows, and we were flying in artists from Syria and Yemen and Palestine and Egypt, the Maghreb as well, and kind of really just getting people together to kind of have a good time and dance and kind of share a night together. But the Home Office had other plans. So I think of the kind of 60 or so visas that we applied for bringing artists in, nearly half of them were blocked and didn't get entry. So, and I mean, it was on kind of, the reasons were so... so laughably nonsensical. It was like things like people were applying who were like, you know, musicians in their late 40s who had like a wife, a house, kids, regular work in Cairo. And they were saying, oh, there are flight risks coming over here and stuff like that. And then we decided that we would, for every artist that couldn't perform, we would get someone up to just read out the letter from the Home Office rejecting their visa application. And that was a really powerful thing to do, but it really showed the absurdity of it. I mean, sometimes they would get the nationality of the person wrong on the piece of paper. One time I was phoned up by someone in the Home Office because they wanted to know if the actor Asif Khan was the convicted terrorist, or were they the Swiss architect. And I said, like, I think there's quite a lot of people with the name of Asif Khan. Like, I think it's not just, okay, you've convicted of terrorism and this architect. Certainly this guy's another one. But and there was even one letter we got rejecting a visa. And also, I mean, these visas cost hundreds of pounds to apply for. And obviously you've had to book flights, you've had to book accommodation. It's a vast cost.
Had already all been done for all these artists that couldn't come.
You can't even apply for the visa unless you have that stuff in place. And
oh my goodness.
One of them, it just said, the visa for so-and-so's name has been declined. Please insert reason for that here. They just hadn't bothered to even delete the bog standard text. Yeah. So, I mean, it was a great party, and we had some really wonderful artists come, particularly, some of the Egyptian and Palestinian artists. And what was really lovely about it as well was that there were also shows kind of across the festival being done by Arab companies and Arab artists that had brought shows, and they would often come to the thing at night. And a lot of them were saying that they never get to hang out with other Arabs from other countries. And that even when they do, there's often an element of suspicion because you don't know how people relate to their own governments or how their governments relate to you. It's very hard to travel for lots of people from Arab countries because of the kind of massive divides created, you know, by the legacy of imperialism and continued imperialism in the region. Yeah. So that felt really positive and powerful. And I think we'd love to kind of do more of those events. Yeah.
Yeah, but it would be nice if the Home Office were more cooperative. In Canada, you know, when the World Social Forum happened in Canada, it was a reminder of why the World Social Forum had never at that point happened in any Western, so-called, you know, industrial, whatever we're calling these, the elite clique of rich nations. It had never happened in any of those countries because, as it turned out, and as we discovered once again, there's this massive... I don't want to exaggerate here, but I think it was like all of the African delegates were denied visas. It was like just an astounding number of Africans who were denied visas, you know, for some stupid reason or another, that they weren't going to go home or whatever. But yeah. the most outrageous, completely outrageous visa denial I've ever heard of was when Iraqi women were denied a visa to do a tour, a speaking tour in the United States, on the basis that they didn't have family in Iraq to return home to. And the reason they didn't have family to return home to was because all of their husbands had been killed by the U.S. military, which was why they were doing a tour in the U.S. But that's the basis for their visa denial, which is
I'd almost say that's unbelievable, but sadly
no, sadly. So you're tuned to Discussions with David, which goes out live most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. UK time, on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and elsewhere. You can find it in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, as well as at patreon.com/DavidRovix, at davidrovix.com, and on the David Rovix app. Henry, did you happen to have a poem handy that you might be able to give us?
Yeah, sure. I could read a poem. This is from a little pamphlet that I put out during lockdown called The Last Lochan.
Oh, wonderful.
And yeah, this is a poem called On the Day We Destroyed the World, I Ate a Peach. On the day we destroyed the world, I ate a peach and threw away a wooden toothbrush that I had bought to save the planet, but which irritated my gums. On the day we destroyed the world, I took the train a single stop, walked 7,892 steps, according to my phone, threw away yogurts and bacon and an avocado from Greece, Denmark, and Peru. On the hottest day ever in Motherwell, I thought about capitalism and about having a child. On the hottest day ever in Glasgow, I watched an advert for a Chillmax cooling pillow. I coveted a Chillmax cooling pillow. I thought about setting fire to the Parliament, then coming home to rest on my Chillmax cooling pillow. The Glasgow Science Centre began to melt into the Clyde. On the hottest day ever in Kuryat, on the hottest day ever in Belfast, on the hottest day ever in Montreal, I thought about capitalism and about having a child on the day we destroyed the world.
Was there a particular day that we destroyed the world, by the way, or is this in the past tense? Or sounds like a typical day to me.
It was written on what was the hottest day ever in Scotland and a lot of other countries, but it was not the hottest day ever. We've surpassed that as well yet again. But yeah,
it's wonderful, and that is the sort of constant dilemma of life. It seems to me like when you are living in one place, and especially if you have small children, and you're trying to create some kind of a sensible environment for them. Like my 4-year-old, calls himself Al Jazeera these days, and because he really likes the Al Jazeera theme music, and you know, I'm really questioning whether maybe I shouldn't be watching Al Jazeera in front of him, but it's. In one day you can have hundreds of people die in an explosion in Beirut that destroys most of the city, but then at the same time there's cops tear gassing people in downtown Portland, and then in my own apartment, you know, we burnt the dinner, you know. So it's like you can focus on any number of things and all of them at the same time, but it's just it's a constant overwhelming thing to go through every day in a way. And I'm so glad that I'm not schizophrenic, because it would be a million times harder in that case, you know, because it feels like, you know, you've got all of these inputs coming in all the time if you're kind of paying attention, even if you're not probably, but especially if you're like a news junkie and you're living in the world at the same time. That's an over. I hear children in the background. You have a kid?
Yeah. It's her bedtime at the minute. Yeah, I've got a 10-month-old baby. So yeah, born since, in fact, she was being born literally last time you were in Pollock Shields. I would have conjugated and seen you, but it was last October or end of September. But I remember thinking, oh, David's about, but I'm too busy at the minute.
A bit busy.
Yeah.
So
I think it's been an absolute blessing to have a baby through lockdown, and like something to focus on and kind of ground you at home and not make you kind of obsess about what's going on in the world. But it does also bring up a lot of things about what kind of a world we're building. And also I was chatting to my friend Josie the other day, who's also a comrade, and she was with a small kid, and she was saying like she worries sometimes that like obviously, you know, communism is right and stuff, but we are kind of raising these kids as if they're in a cult. They kind of get to school and be like, oh no, like you shouldn't be exploiting people and stuff. And the teacher be like, I'm pretty sure that is how we do it in this country.
Right, that is, greed is good, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, one of the first lessons they do in Scotland is when they're 5-year-olds, they go in and they do a lesson called People Who Help Us. And one of the people who helps us that come in is a cop to talk to
them. Oh, great.
Yeah, how's that going to go down when our kids get there?
When my teenage daughter was 5, she was in class painting pictures of fighter jets with X's through them and that sort of thing, and no war. And then when the teacher asked her what's her favorite thing and what makes her happy, she said, tax the rich. And I don't know if she even understood what that meant at the time. It was like, whoa, I don't know. Yeah, we maybe a bit too much propaganda at the home front. I don't know. Yeah. But having a kid you're told that when you have a kid, this is going to change your perspective. But at the same time, if you're basically an empathetic sort of person, then that, you know, that's not necessarily true. But then sometimes, despite yourself, it is true. Have you had that experience that it's been somewhat profound?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, I think you're absolutely right. If you're an empathetic person and you think about society and care, then you've had these thoughts. But like, certainly for me, I guess it's the first experience I've had of that kind of absolute care, kind of daily caring for someone. And that, like, for lots of people, that's not having a kid that they experience that through. But I think it is very profound to do that as your daily practice is looking after and keeping someone alive, and kind of thinking about how that's most of the work in the world, right? How that labor, that kind of reproductive labor is the real work that's done, that's kind of uncredited and invisible and certainly never ever paid. I think it's been and again, like in theory, obviously, you know, I've read my Federici and thought about that and stuff, but I think really kind of living it is a powerful thing as well. And then also just I think thinking it's a great thing to spend a lot of time with small kids, like not even your own small kid, but suddenly you're slightly altered in the world as a person that kids come up to and chat to. Like if you're a guy without a child, no kid in the park is going to come tell you anything. But suddenly you have a child and they're like, oh, this person's fine. I can come and tell him about my stamp collection for 3 hours.
Absolutely.
It's nice to have that kind of change. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that seems to be happening with the lockdown phenomenon is people sort of vicariously living through their children, which people do anyway. But I mean, like if you have a baby, that seems healthier because there's certain things that a baby obviously needs. And when you're in lockdown, you can just provide those things and no problem. But if you have like a kid who should be in school, then there's, at least with many parents, this desire to impose everything like some kind of a school-like structure on their children, even though they don't have the time to impose it and they're really the wrong person to be doing that. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of terrible things going on, but it gives the parents the chance to remember what day of the week it is anyway. So
to impose the switch. I mean, it's been interesting kind of seeing that, like just in the building that we stay in, the kind of different kids having different experiences of that. And I definitely I'm more in favor of the kids that I've just sort of seen go totally feral and that are out kind of grubbing about in the garden all day, every day.
Exactly.
And the kids that are being drilled on history or maths that definitely I wouldn't be able to teach someone. I don't know whether their parents can. But
the feral kids will end up learning about history somehow or other anyway, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
By watching Al Jazeera with their fathers. Or Henry, can you do another poem for it? That was wonderful. And what is this book? This is a book you just put out during the pandemic. Have you been inspired to do much extra creativity since the pandemic? And are you getting by? What's been happening on that level in terms of how many travel plans? Your book about McLean is in its second printing. You might have had some book tour gigs to do, but that's all canceled. Or have you had that sort of thing going on?
Mostly the book tour for that is kind of done. I kind of spent 2019 doing a lot of festivals and stuff, but there were kind of the kind of smaller community events and labor clubs and stuff, so it was a shame not to get to do some of those. But I was going to be staying home with a baby anyway, so I didn't notice too much. But
good coincidence,
the events work has gone, and that's a big shame. And kind of how, so my partner's a primary school teacher, so she's going to go back and teach full-time, and I'm going to look after the baby full-time, which is grand because she has a secure job, and kind of working freelance in the arts is a pretty tricky gig at the minute, I think. So I'm kind of happy.
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
And she's, is she going back into school physically to teach?
Yeah,
are they opening up physically like normal or in some modified way?
So she's kind of on she's the president of the local trade union exec and stuff. So she was kind of involved in a lot of the meetings and discussions about it. And there was a huge amount of work to build a blended model where you would have bubbles of small numbers of kids in and other kids at home. And you would kind of clean the school in between, and how that would work and how, where the extra money for cleaning and staff and stuff would come from. And then one day before the end of term, before the summer, the Scottish government changed their minds and said, everyone's going back in, no social distancing, no face masks. We're just going to see what happens. So they tore up all that work. And I think they've already been back a couple of weeks at schools, and they've already been kind of quite a few little spikes of coronavirus around schools in Scotland. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, I'm torn on it. I think it's important that the kids get back, and Liv definitely is really in favor of that. But I think it's really difficult for teachers who maybe like live at home with someone that's shielding or someone that's high risk or are the only person that visits their elderly parents or something, to then suddenly be in a room with, if you're a high school teacher, maybe with 120 different teenagers a day with no social distancing and no masks, like how can you safe.
Pretty scary. If you haven't actually taken care of the virus yet, then that seems like a real bad idea. Like in New York City, I think 75 teachers died before they shut down the schools of COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same old imperative that the economy wins over everything, basically, and they've got to get people back to work, so they've got to get the kids into school. Is there reason?
Such a...
Certainly, there was an interesting survey among the teachers' union. I think something like 90% of teachers are all members of the Educational Institute of Scotland here, and the vast majority of them said they were willing to take strike action in defence of a colleague that felt they were in unsafe working conditions. So I think we might see kind of some labour organising around that.
I think so. We'll be seeing a lot of teacher strikes in a lot of places where they're going to be opening up the schools like that. Yeah. Would you do another poem for us? That was so good. And what's the book called again? And can people find it on the web?
Yeah, it's put out by a press called Speculative Books. So if you go to their website, you can find it.
Do they specialize in poetry or?
Yeah, they put out just a little pamphlet of poetry each month.
Nice.
Usually by Scottish poets. Jim Monaghan's got one out.
Great.
Sorry, I knew what I was going to read. I'll read the title one, which is called The Last Lochan. A lochan is a small loch, and a loch is a lake, for anyone wondering. The winter's wind is hot this Feb, and strangely from the south, and a final small red grouse has crawled into its mouth, picking up its feathered hump and getting feathered fat before it turns cocoon, then butterfly, then bat, to see at once the lastest lustrous details of the scene. The loch itself, a lochan now, an ever-shrinking green, is glad to have our hands placed gently in its heart, to hold us as we hold it and force the world apart. The grouse is fearful thirsty now and heaving heavy sighs, to answer that we question should we mourn or organise. The heat has killed the swans, so arms at least no more are broken, and soon it melts us all just as a final word is spoken. Please, as Scotland slumps into a dried-up lochan of its own, and our oil rigs and first ministers are finally alone. There's some cheery ones as well. It seems like you're two really grim climate change poems.
Oh, it's great. Great imagery. Wonderful. That last line.
Yeah,
you were an artist in residence at the Glasgow City Council, I was reading. And first of all, I didn't know the Glasgow City Council had any artists in residence. But when reading your job description, it was, I quote, to explore impossible and necessary demands, which is like fantastic, coming right out of the French uprising of 68, this idea, and Rob Johnson's wonderful song and a lot of others. But what was this artist in residence position, and did
we did take a kind of situationist approach to it. It was an interesting thing. It was the new council was elected, and part of their manifesto was that every ward in the city would have an artist in residence in it. So I think the city's kind of divided into 40 different constituencies that vote for councillors. So each one got an artist in residence with a £10,000. Kind of budget was the concept. It's not quite how it worked out. These things always kind of mutate in the end when there's too much bureaucracy. But what we wanted to do, it was myself and an artist called Alec Finley, was kind of just explore proposals as an art form and hopefully make something, but mostly just talk to people about if you could completely transform this neighborhood, which was kind of Greater Pollock Shields was the neighborhood I had, which is where I live in the south side of Glasgow. And it was kind of to ask people kind of for their very real kind of criticisms and proposals, but also for their transformational ones. So like we could spend the £10,000 like cleaning up people's bins and filling in potholes, and that also would be a work of art and a community work of art and a good use of that money. But also we could imagine what if we used the coal mines underneath the neighborhood as a water heating supply and built an open air swimming pool in the middle of the main park and heated it sustainably with that and kind of explore these things. There were people interested in getting rid of all the cars from the neighborhood, but also building a massive stables and bringing in horses the neighborhood. And
wonderful.
It was a lot of fun, and kids enjoyed it as well. We kind of did stuff going into schools and talking about what they would get rid of or add to this bit of town. But it was frustrating in the end. What we wanted to do was a lot of people came back. There's a lot of green space in this bit of the city, but there's also a huge amount of derelict land. It's something like 95% of people in the south side of Glasgow live within 100 meters of a derelict plot. So, I mean, it's pretty much everywhere that there's derelict housing or old factory ground. And people talked a lot about wanting to do something with that, to like have an opportunity or the tools to make something of it. And so we decided we would use the money and we would invest it in a wind turbine, in a renewable energy producing thing. And then the money that we got from selling that electricity back to the electric board every year would every year be used to buy bicycles, beehives, gardening equipment, and just stuff from the list of things wanted in the neighborhood. And those would then, there'd be like a massive trellis in the middle of one of the parks. And this stuff would just be attached to it every few months once it'd been bought for people to just take, but also you could order stuff and it could be delivered to you. And we thought that was fun, but also interesting because there'd been a lot of talk about sustainability and how do you make the art sustainable or the community project sustainable. And the problem with these projects is always the council is up for giving you 10 grand, which sounds like a huge amount of money. But any lasting intervention, anything worthwhile, can't really be done with that money, and particularly not when it's spent on a one-off basis. You can't build anything, you can't organize, you can't employ anyone to organize or make anything. So we were saying like, okay, what if we use the money to produce a small amount of money for this every year? And they said, oh no, we can't do that. That's an investment and this needs to be one-off capital spending. We were like, okay, we asked for something sustainable. They were like, yeah, but that we're not going to be able to write that off as tax in the same way that we need to. And so, but in the end, we didn't actually get to complete our, I thought, possible demand. So we should have gone for one of the really impossible ones.
After all, right? Like what? Getting rid of all the cars and bringing in the horses.
Bringing in the horses. There was free restaurants on every street. The one I liked was just there'd been a massive strike in the city kind of just before we were doing it, which was a pay gap dispute where basically the trade unions had managed to win the case that vast numbers of women working in care work, working in food production all across the city, all council jobs had been systematically underpaid versus their male colleagues. And they won a vast payout, hundreds of millions of pounds to these women. And they'd gone on strike and the refuse collectors had wildcat struck in solidarity, and it had been a big event. And someone put in a proposal for just a massive statue of a care worker, like a sort of Soviet style colossus in the center of our bit of town. I would have been up for that.
Yeah, that's good. You won't forget how important care workers are when you have a really big statue. Great. Henry Bell, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Nice catching up with you a little bit.
Yeah, great to see you. Been waiting. You can make it to Scotland before too long.
Yeah, someday. I wouldn't want to make any predictions. I've been asking people for predictions for the future, but it's you think there's going to be an election in the United States in November? Here's your chance to make a public prediction.
I don't even know if I want there to be one. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Fingers crossed to be a revolution before that.
A revolution before that. Excellent. Yeah, good. Yeah, I'm crossing my fingers for that too. Good plan. I'll just aim in that direction, actually. Yeah. Thanks, Henry. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Take care. Cheers, David.
You too. And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Henry Bell. You can find all these discussions archived in various places, including on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovics in the Discussions with David playlist. You'll also find them all in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or go to davidrovics.com or get the David Rovics mobile app. If you want to support my broadcasting efforts, you're most welcome to become a patron at patreon.com/davidrovics, where all these broadcasts are also available for anyone to download, along with some patron-only offerings as well. If you're in the Portland area, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up to receive text notifications so you can be part of Portland emergency eviction response when the investment banks that own half of the city start trying to evict so many of our neighbors. I hope to see some of you tomorrow when I'll be doing a concert from right here in my living room at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Western European time, 10 p.m. in Copenhagen. Remember, don't pay the rent. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for